Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org. This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's time for the news roundup. What a difference a month can make. On July 4th, President Biden was heralding our independence from COVID-19.
The 4th of July is a day of special celebration, for we are emerging from the darkness of a year of pandemic and isolation.
But now the situation has changed.
From the moment I was elected, I said I'd always give it to you straight from the shoulder. And we need some straight talk right now. Because there's a lot of fear and misinformation in the country, and we need to cut through it with facts, with science, with the truth.
That was President Biden speaking to reporters about the sudden resurgence of the pandemic in America, thanks to a fast-moving variant and a slow-moving public. The about-face has led to the return of some mask mandates and even some tough new vaccination measures. But how far are we willing to go to avoid a repeat of winter 2020? Joining us to talk about it is Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Julie, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Anita Kumar. She's a White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico. Anita, it's always great to have you on.
Thanks for having me back.
And Jeff Zeleny, chief national affairs correspondent for CNN. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So first, let's start with that big news. The masks are back. This week, the CDC issued new guidance that says fully vaccinated people should still wear masks indoors if they're in an area with a high COVID transmission rate. And right now, that includes more than 63% of the country. And scientists say we should expect that number to go up. Julie, explain a little bit more about what's behind this apparent about face from the CDC.
Well, I think it would help if we thought about the Delta variant as its own new disease rather than just the latest incarnation. We could call it COVID-21. It is not really the same ailment that we saw last year. It is much, much more transmissible. Overnight, the Washington Post got a hold of a CDC internal document that we hope will be made public later on today. And it says that the Delta variant is as transmissible as chickenpox, which is one of the most transmissible diseases out there, that it's much easier to catch. So everything we thought we learned, or everything we did learn last year about how you can prevent this, wear a mask, don't be, you know, in close quarters with someone who has the disease for more than a few minutes, a lot of that stuff is now out the window. It is much easier to catch this. And it turns out that people who've been fully vaccinated can get it and spread it. They're much less likely to come down with severe disease or be hospitalized or die. So it's not that the vaccines are ineffective. It's just that this variant is so strong and so transmissible that it is safer if people actually put their masks back on.
And for the unvaccinated, what do we know about the effect of the Delta variant?
Well, they're still trying to figure out if the Delta variant is more severe than earlier iterations of this disease. But certainly we know that if you're unvaccinated and younger, you are just as likely to get very sick, end up in the hospital, potentially die. There are many, we're seeing across the world, not just in the United States, people who are catching this variant with severe disease, which we didn't see as much with the earlier variants.
Anita, for months we've heard this simple messaging from the White House: if you're vaccinated, you're good. How does this new information complicate that message, and could it present some real problems in the push to get people to vaccinate?
Yeah, I mean, it is confusing, and there are people that feel like this is a back and forth. I mean, even early this week, over the weekend, White House officials were still debating whether to do this mask, this change in the mask guidance, and what other things that they should do. And so we've seen a lot of people sort of surprised at some of the what was done this week and what the president said this week, just because only a few days ago it didn't seem they were going to go this far. Some would argue they should go further, but the White House has been reluctant. There are people in the White House and who are advising the White House that are concerned some of these new measures, both with masks and also vaccinations, which I guess we'll talk about in a moment, you know, are both going to confuse people, but also turn people off again. You know, that people are going to say, look, I'm done with this. I don't want to do this again. I don't want to go through this again. And then actually they'll push away and say, I don't want to get vaccinated. I was thinking about it. I don't want to. I don't want to wear a mask. And of course, we've seen a lot of local and state officials across the country saying, pushing back, and actually members of Congress saying, look, I'm not going to do this. And so what we have is what we had last year, this confusing patchwork across the country where some people are saying one thing and some people are saying another.
Right, Jeff, you know, some governors, including those in Nebraska and Texas, have already indicated they do not plan to follow the new guidance. Meanwhile, Atlanta, Los Angeles, and the District of Columbia have announced they plan to reinstate mask mandates. Are we about to see a repeat of 2020, stricter restrictions in left-leaning areas and little to no restrictions in more conservative spots?
I think we definitely are. We are seeing it in those states, and it really is a red state, blue state divide. But even more than that, as we saw a year ago, blue cities, if you will, cities that are either led by Democratic mayors or tend to vote Democratic inside red states are also doing ordinances. The latest example is just coming out on Friday. It is the city of Birmingham, Alabama, is requiring face masks for all city buildings and public buildings. Of course, the state of Alabama, deep red, is not. But look, we are definitely seeing this a familiar divide between the Republican governors and the White House pushing back. But I think as we step back and we head into the month of August here, it's really so dramatic watching President Biden on Thursday talk about requirements, even using the word mandate, walking right up to that line. And that has always been a word for the last several months that the White House just simply has not wanted to get anywhere close to. But now they believe that if they are requiring federal workers, which we'll talk about more, some private sector companies will step up and do the same, which we've already seen. But you really have to wonder. The White House was so focused on reaching that goal by July 4th of hitting 70% of all Americans becoming vaccinated, which they still have not hit, by the way, at the end of the month. They're almost there, but they still haven't hit it. Did that cloud any thinking in terms of sounding another alarm, as Julie was saying, about really what is a different type of virus? Did that, essentially slow walk this urgent call for new mask guidance, et cetera? I think the month of July will be a critical period that we'll go back and look at and study in terms of a turning point here in this pandemic.
I want to talk about that new guidance for federal workers. But first, we got this question from Aileen, who says, the unvaccinated and younger people getting sick, does that include kids? Julie, do we know that yet?
It does include kids. We are seeing more kids getting sick, and we're also seeing kids spreading. This is a big problem of why you need, even some vaccinated people need masks, because there's concern that vaccinated people will pick up the virus. They won't get sick, but they'll go home and spread it to their unvaccinated kids. So yes, it is, I think the way to think about it is that until recently we thought about if you were vaccinated, you were safe. Now you need to think about it that if you're vaccinated, you're safer. It's definitely better to be vaccinated than not, but it's not enough to be vaccinated with the Delta variant.
Now, during a speech yesterday, President Biden addressed the changed CDC guidance and issued a new set of rules for federal workers. Dakota notes Biden is actually giving them a choice. He's not insisting that anyone get vaccinated. Julie, this is being referred to colloquially as a mandate, but explain exactly what the Biden administration is saying here.
It reminds me of the Affordable Care Act mandate, where you had a choice to either have health insurance or pay a fine. In this case, your choice is to either get vaccinated or be tested repeatedly to prove that you are negative. There are some people who cannot be vaccinated. So, there does need to be an out for some people. So basically what this is an effort to keep the federal workforce safe and say that we know that there won't be people with the virus in our buildings. Although now that we have all these breakthrough cases, and in many cases they'll be asymptomatic, it could become problematic because I imagine a lot of people who are vaccinated and have asymptomatic breakthrough cases aren't even being tested. They don't have any symptoms. Why would they be tested? But at least it's, the first layer of trying to keep this from continuing to spread.
Well, Jill tweets regarding children, please remember none of our young children can get vaccinated, and yet we hear it virtually virtually nothing about how best to protect them. We're heading back to school here in Georgia next week. And this has been a point of pressure throughout the pandemic, Julie, getting kids back into the classroom. But with this Delta variant, are we seeing any shift in what parents can expect?
Yes, I think we're seeing a shift towards universal masking in schools, not just for younger kids who can't be vaccinated, but in many cases, even for older kids who can be and in some cases are vaccinated. That this happened pretty much just this week. There was an effort to get kids back in school in a relatively normal setting. But now that we have the Delta variant, I think there's certainly the effort to get kids back physically in school. Nobody wants another year of remote learning. But I think that there's going to be more masking and more social distancing, and it's going to be less, quote unquote, normal than it otherwise would have been.
But again, is this a place where we could see redder states leaning against universal masking in schools, and in blue states, kids are wearing masks?
Yes, absolutely. And we'll have to see, you know, if this becomes a huge place to spread the virus around from kids back to their families.
Couple of messages we've gotten here. Rich emails, I have felt and still feel that if a person refuses to be vaccinated, they should be fined. And if they still refuse, they should be arrested and jailed. But AC has a different idea. They tweet, why doesn't President Biden offer a federal stimulus check of at least $500 to everyone who can prove that they are vaccinated? Imagine how fast we'd reach herd immunity. We'll be back with more of the News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Audible. Chasing Ghislaine is a new investigative podcast series from executive producer James Patterson and hosted by veteran journalist Vicky Ward, who has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for nearly 20 years. Epstein's story intertwines with the disgraced heiress Ghislaine Maxwell, Epstein's ex-lover, former employee, and alleged co-conspirator. Chasing Ghislaine is available exclusively on Audible. To start listening, go to audible.com/chasing.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is back. This season is all about investing. We've got stories of big bets, bubble spotting, and cute animals, too. Every Wednesday till Labor Day from NPR's Planet Money.
We're rounding up the week's top news. Let's take a step back and look at the state of COVID in this country more broadly. Cases are up 55% from last week and 144% from just 2 weeks ago. Julie, when we look at this current surge, is it all Delta or are there other factors at play?
It is almost all Delta. That's what we're starting to see. It was 83%. I think it's now in the 90s. And as we said, because this strain is so much more transmissible, it's easy to see why it is taking over. It's exactly what we've seen in the other countries where this has become the dominant strain. First, we saw it in India and then in Britain, although it's good to see that in Britain, cases are starting to come down, even though Britain opened up society a lot more in the past week. That's something that is puzzling some scientists. But one thing we know about viruses is that they kind of ebb and flow on their own, regardless of what we do.
I want to refer back to those messages we got from Rich and AC. Rich saying if people refuse to be vaccinated, they should be arrested and jailed. AC saying, why doesn't President Biden offer a stimulus check of at least $500 to everyone? What do we know about who is still vaccine hesitant and whether they can still be reached?
Well, some of them clearly can, because we've seen vaccines go up since the Delta variant started to become dominant and, it, you know, back in the headlines. We're seeing a little bit of an uptick in vaccines. And in fact, President Biden this week did suggest that states and local governments use federal money that they already have to give people a $100 stipend if they get vaccinated to try and reach out. So we still see a lot of carrots and we're seeing some sticks, more and more private and some city, local requirements for getting vaccines. But so we have a combination. On vaccine mandates are nothing new. Kids have to be vaccinated in order to enter kindergarten. They've had to be vaccinated for decades. This is not something that we've never seen before. There is still some concern from people who say, well, the vaccines are still only approved, you know, under an emergency authorization. They don't have full FDA approval, which we're expecting sometime in the fall. So there are some people that are clearly still reachable, although there are going to be a number of people who are just going to continue to say no.
Former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, says it's not only bad right now, it's probably worse than we realize.
I think we're vastly underestimating the level of Delta spread right now, because I think people who are vaccinated, who might, you know, develop some mild symptoms and might develop a breakthrough case, by and large, aren't going out and getting tested. If you've been vaccinated and you develop a mild cold right now, you don't think you have COVID.
Julie, you alluded to this earlier, but what implications could this have for the country if there's a big chunk of vaccinated people who have COVID and just don't know because it's not harming them very much?
Yeah, and that's one of the big problems, because according to this CDC document, the average spread, rather than one or two people, which is what we saw with the earlier variants, is now eight or nine people. So if you're walking around asymptomatic, you could be spreading it without knowing it. And that may be one of the reasons why we're seeing cases go up so much.
What is the general state of testing in the U.S. right now?
Testing is going up a little bit, but there's certainly not as much testing as there has been. And, you know, as Scott says, why would you go get tested if you're not having symptoms or if you think you have a summer cold?
Tom emailed us this. I was in a mini super spreader event on July 20th. 15 fully vaccinated but unmasked adults and two unvaccinated small children. Only three of us failed to get infected. Fortunately, our host fell ill the next day and out of caution got tested and warned the rest of us. In the meantime, I'd infected my wife. Not only can you get infected while vaccinated, you will be a carrier and infect others. Complacency and ignorance are still our worst enemies. Thanks for sharing that with us, Tom. Anita, when there's such uneven messaging coming from political leadership, depending upon the state you live in, what do you think that means for the country's ability to recover from this long term?
Yeah, this is exactly, obviously, with a different president in the White House, what we saw last year. President Trump struggled with this exact thing. You know, his response was really just sort of announce that he was going to force governors to do things. But of course, he couldn't force them. President Biden has been sort of the opposite. He's been very reluctant to do that. And, you know, now we're seeing him have a little bit of a tougher language this week. But it is not only confusing, but of course, you know, if you just look at the simple science here, it can't help when one state does one thing and another does something else, right? The virus doesn't care whether you're in Florida or Georgia. It moves whether you whatever state you're in. So that is a problem. I mean, there needs to be, as a lot of people say, some U.S. guidelines. And then, of course, there are a lot of people that were happy, scientists and medical officials that were happy about the change in the mask guidelines this week. But there are many doctors who say, and public health officials who say, it was a little bit too late, that they should have done that earlier. I've been talking to some people who have advised the White House in the past, or health officials that have been talking to the White House, who felt that the White House and the federal government, I should say, not just the White House, was a little bit too late on a lot of these things, and that they should have not been so afraid to be forceful a while ago, and that it was a little bit too late for that. And so there's some frustration there and some regret. And of course, when you talk to the White House, they say, look, we want people to get vaccinated, and they are afraid to do certain things because they are afraid people will say, I'm not getting vaccinated now. And their goal really is to get vaccinations.
Well, and Jeff, we have the pandemic itself, the health concerns, the deaths we've seen around the globe in the past year plus now. But then there are also other ripple effects, kids being out of school, the economic impacts. What would you say are the biggest concerns right now as this pandemic continues to linger?
I think the biggest concerns, certainly first and foremost, are the medical concerns. I mean, we have been talking really throughout the last several weeks about the economic concerns, which of course are real, and the inconvenient concerns, if you will. But I think the medical concerns really is the administration and the CDC and other health officials are trying to get their arms around the messaging on this Delta variant. I think, you know, there's no doubt that trying to streamline the messaging here, what it means for the vaccinated, what it means for the unvaccinated. And the president actually has played a role in some of this confusion. He has repeatedly called this the pandemic for the unvaccinated. And that's not now necessarily true. So I think the, you know, there is a ripple effect for the economy. Probably, you know, one of the biggest issues holding up the economy has been a labor shortage. And this is certainly going to, you know, have... give some second thoughts for some compromised workers or older workers or others about coming back into the workforce here. And this is all coming as the unemployment benefits are on the verge of expiring in the states that have not already canceled them. So certainly the economy is a worry, but I think first and foremost, the health concerns. But again, when the president was speaking at the White House on Thursday, I was really struck by it. He said in an answer to a question, he said, I asked the Justice Department to determine if companies can legally mandate vaccines. That is not something that we have heard him say. And he said, it's still a question if the government can mandate the whole country. I don't know that yet. So that certainly opens the door to the fact that he has dramatically shifted his thinking about what the federal government can do. So by and large, again, as we end this month of July, I think the messaging is such a challenge for this White House and just trying to determine what levers of government they can use, which ones are wise to use, and which ones are not.
Abigail asks this, why has it taken so long to get FDA approval? I know unvaccinated people, including my own brother, who refused to get the vaccine until it's fully approved by the FDA. What does the FDA approval process involve, and what is being done to move this forward? Julie, what can you tell us?
Well, there are a lot of layers of review. I mean, this is the FDA is the gold standard for approval of drugs and vaccines. And it just, you know, there's a lot of pressure for them to get this fast. And on the other hand, there is still lingering concern among the people who are refusing to get vaccinated that the emergency authorization came too fast, that this was rushed through the FDA. And of course, President Trump last year kind of threatened to rush it through the FDA. So I think the FDA is being super careful to, you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's. They know, obviously, that they need to do this, you know, as soon as humanly possible. But they don't want to look like there's, you know, politics that are getting into this. And there's just a lot of data to review.
Before we let you go, Julie, I don't want to ignore the fact that this latest surge is having a huge impact on our health system and health workers. What can you tell us about that?
Yes, and that, you know, when you talk about the pandemic of the unvaccinated, the one big difference we're seeing is that in places where there are many unvaccinated people, that's where you're seeing the strain on the healthcare system. Places like Missouri and Texas and Florida, where people are not just getting this, they're getting sicker, they're ending up in ICUs, and health workers are exhausted and frustrated and in some cases angry. And, you know, if you are vaccinated and don't get sick but need other kinds of health care in those places, you can also be out of luck. So it's really not just the pandemic of the unvaccinated. Everybody is involved in this. And I think that's sort of one of the things that we need to communicate is that you're not just getting vaccinated for yourself, you're getting vaccinated for the rest of your community and for the continued, you know, livelihood of your health care system.
Before we move on to politics, a note that fire season is well underway in California. Blazes are currently consuming more than 500 square miles in the Golden State. The largest of them is the Dixie Fire, which is currently threatening 10,000 structures in Northern California. According to Cal Fire, 2020 was one of the most severe fire seasons on record, with over 9,000 structures destroyed and 31 people killed. Well, let's turn to politics. In Washington, after weeks of negotiations on infrastructure, it appears we could have a deal. On Wednesday, the Senate voted to move forward on a bipartisan $1.2 trillion deal, half of which will be new spending on public projects. Here's Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg celebrating the agreement on CNBC.
This is a historic generational investment, and I think it speaks to how urgent it is that you have senators who don't agree on much, Republicans and Democrats, not to mention business leaders and labor union leaders who, again, don't necessarily agree on much when it comes to the economy, saying we've got to do this.
Well, Anita, just this week, negotiations seemed like they were about to fall apart. How did the White House and Senate reach an agreement?
Yeah, it's been a stop and start for months now, hasn't it? You know, partly it was that the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer really pushed and said, look, we're going to vote. We're going to get this done. And, you know, a lot of it was just sitting down at a table in a room and hashing this out. You know, there was, obviously, there's this bipartisan group of senators. There's the White House. You know, the Republicans really had Senator Rob Portman do a lot of the negotiating for them. And then, of course, President Biden was involved. And he also had one of his top aides, Steve Ricchetti, sort of sitting down with Rob Portman and just getting some of these things done. Now, Democrats, there are some Democrats that say, look, the only reason it got done is because too many concessions were made on the Democratic side, on the White House side. And they'll be arguing about that for a while. It does look like they are generally supportive and they will need those votes. But, you know, a lot of it was just the continued push by staff, lawmakers, and of course the president himself. This is something, you know, we hadn't seen from President Trump. We hadn't really even seen from President Obama, a different kind of negotiating, exactly what President Biden said he would try to do.
Well, Jeff, Wednesday's vote to advance the legislation was 67 to 32. Tell us about the 17 Republicans who voted in the bill's favor. What motivated them?
I mean, this certainly is something we have not seen in quite a long while, that there are 17 Republicans joining all Democrats to vote yes to advance this. And it's really interesting when you look through the list of these 17 Republicans. It starts with the Senate Republican leader, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He voted yes on this, as did, as Anita was just saying, Rob Portman, the Republican senator from Ohio. He's a former OMB director in the Bush administration. He is someone who really is trusted by a lot of his fellow Republicans. So he brought on board a lot of other Republican members like Mitt Romney, like Roy Blunt, Richard Burr. So if you really look at the list of these 17, several of them are retiring. They're not running for re-election, which makes it easier to vote for something like this. Rob Portman, not running for re-election. Roy Blunt, Richard Burr aren't either. If you also look at some of them, like Susan Collins, of course, a familiar name. If there's ever a Republican who wants to work in a bipartisan way, she's certainly on that list. And then several others were just elected last year, so they won't face re-election for five more years. So this is, you know, certainly several did not vote for it, and we do not know at the end of the day how many of these 17 will vote on the bigger package. But it's kind of a mix of them, but it's still really every last senator who really has a history in the Senate of working with both sides is on that list. And Mitt Romney, of course, a newer senator, was also helping with these negotiations. So certainly a smattering of Republicans, but by and large, people who don't have a tough Republican primary ahead of them. Because we saw former President Donald Trump come out hard against this, going after Mitch McConnell by name for working with Democrats on this. But look, this is one exception to the divide we've seen in Washington. They truly do want to get something done on infrastructure.
Julie, is there anything in the package we should know from a healthcare standpoint?
Well, not in the bipartisan package, but the more they can get into in the bipartisan package, the more room they're going to have in the package, the follow-up package, the bill that they're going to do with just Democratic votes to expand Medicare benefits, possibly to do some long-term care. I mean, to extend these subsidies for people who buy coverage on the Affordable Care Act. So there are a number of health priorities that are waiting in the follow-up bill. And it's important for the health priorities that the bipartisan bill get through so that they can do those sort of hard infrastructure that they've been talking about, the roads and bridges and broadband.
Anita, really briefly, we know there's been a lot of debate over what the term infrastructure should include. Can you give us just a broad overview of what's in this package?
Yeah, this package is what people sort of consider traditional infrastructure: roads, bridges, freight, rail, public transportation, although not as much as they had hoped, broadband, ports, waterways, those kinds of things. All those other pieces that we've heard about, what the White House likes to call human infrastructure, are going to be saved for this other package that we were just talking about.
We've been talking to Julie Rovner. She's the chief Washington correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Julie, it's always great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
More from you and our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A. Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
we as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult.
Let's get back to the news roundup. Now, this week has been a roller coaster for U.S. Olympics watchers. Simone Biles stepped back from the gymnastics all around after a case of the twisties, but her teammate, Sunisa Lee, not only stepped in, but walked away with gold.
I had to hit the best routines of my life to get here, so I just stayed focused, and I just try not to think about winning a medal, anything like that, because either way, I would have been proud of myself for competing here.
For the latest, I spoke to NPR's Tom Goldman, who's currently in Tokyo. We connected yesterday, and I asked him about the reasons behind Simone Biles' withdrawal.
Simone Biles talked about mental health challenges and has really begun anew the conversation that's been going on for some time, you know, about mental health and elite athletes. We've heard that from the tennis player Naomi Osaka when she withdrew from a couple of Grand Slam tennis tournaments in the last few months. We've been hearing about it from Michael Phelps, the greatest Olympian medals-wise in recent years. And Simone Biles has really rekindled that discussion. Now, I did a story today, this is not just a plug for my story, on this phenomenon called the twisties, which is essentially kind of a mental block that gymnasts get. They do amazing things, death-defying things, I think we can say, and they train so hard that they really cognitively don't have to think about these things when they're doing it, when they're in midair. And when they get the twisties, essentially, they're getting lost in the air, which is really kind of a frightening concept. And Simone Biles acknowledged to reporters the day after she withdrew from the team event that she was having, quote, a little bit of the twisties. As I said, it's when they lose their way in the air. And what she did was she decided to pull out. She didn't want to risk injury because if you start overthinking what you're doing in the air, gymnasts in particular, because they are doing very dangerous moves that look so easy, on a 4-inch balance beam or wherever. And when they get airborne and they start thinking about it, bad things could happen. So she decided to withdraw. She also, very charitably, and all of her teammates supported her. It was the team competition. And she said she didn't want to kind of get in their way. They had trained so hard, and she didn't want to hinder them in their quest for a medal. You know, she has been criticized on social media for being a quitter, for choking. Those are people who really don't understand what these gymnasts go through. And her team in the post-event press conference, all very supportive, genuinely supportive of what she did. And they went ahead and won a silver, which was a great accomplishment.
One of the biggest elephants in the room, as you alluded to, is COVID-19. According to new data released by the Tokyo Olympics organizers, more than 120 people have tested positive in the past few weeks. What do we know about how this health crisis is being navigated during the Games?
Well, you know, they are just trying to get through it. The head of the World Health Organization, you know, spoke to the International Olympic Committee before the Olympics started. And he said the key is not the numbers, you know, because we're all reporting on the numbers of how many people are positive. He said the key is how they manage it. Do they get it under control? Do they prevent an outbreak? Although we do a lot of reporting about it and we're watching it and athletes are being tested every day and we in the media are being tested, they still have been successful if you gauge success by preventing a major outbreak.
Is anything around this Olympics sparking a larger conversation about the practicality of having this kind of event, how the IOC functions as a governing body?
There have been a lot of questions leading up to this. Why is the IOC trying to force this thing? Well, the answer often is money. I should note, to be fair, that a lot of the money they make goes to sports all over the world and national governing bodies for sports all over the world. And a lot of the sports, a lot of the lesser sports, which make the Olympics wonderful, need that money. So when we vilify the IOC for doing this just for the money, you have to remember that. But yeah, I think in general, though, there are traditional complaints about the Olympics that are, very valid here. I mentioned the venues, which are empty. You know, Japanese organizers spent what's been reported as $30 billion on this, and that's just a lot of money, and it's cost overruns, and it seems like Olympics are always that's always happening in Olympic Games. You are finding that the Olympic Games aren't as popular among cities and countries when, you know, as far as the bidding process, people don't want to incur this kind of expenditure and then debt after the games. They don't want to be saddled with a bunch of white elephant facilities. So yeah, people are rethinking, they're talking about it, but you know what, Jen? They just keep plowing ahead. Mm-hmm. The next Olympics will be in just in about 7 months in February. And I think what the IOC really wants to do is get through this one, finish it, make sure there's no huge outbreak, get through the Beijing Winter Olympics and make sure nothing else happens, because the pandemic may very well still be with us. And then they can breathe easy when it gets to France, in Paris in 2024, and then in LA in 2028, places that they know can hold this. And there are, you know, already venues built, and hopefully the pandemic won't be with us then.
That was Tom Goldman of NPR. He's part of a team in Tokyo reporting on the Games. Let's get back to politics. Former President Donald Trump's picks for a special Texas House election lost this week. Politics watchers called GOP Representative Jake Elzey's win an upset and a bit of a black eye for the former president. Trump's influence will be put to the test again this week in a special election in Ohio. Now, the House Select Committee looking into the January 6th insurrection started its hearings this week. We heard from four police officers who were at the Capitol that day, including Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone.
My law enforcement career prepared me to cope with some of the aspects of this experience. Being an officer, you know your life is at risk whenever you walk out the door, even if you don't expect otherwise law-abiding citizens to take up arms against you. But nothing, truly nothing, has prepared me to address those elected members of our government who continue to deny the events of that day, and in doing so, betray their oath of office. Those very members whose lives, offices, staff members, I was fighting so desperately to defend. I agreed to speak here today and have talked publicly about what happened, because I don't think our response to the insurrection should have anything to do with political parties.
That's Metropolitan Police Officer Michael Fanone. Anita, what were your big takeaways from the hearings on Tuesday?
You know, it's been a lot of months since January, obviously. And, you know, Washington, in some respects, had kind of moved on. A lot of the country had moved on. And so, to me, this sort of brought it all back, right? This is the kickoff, the start of what we're going to see now for months, maybe a year or more, with these hearings. You know, a lot of what we had heard, or what we heard the other day, were things that we had sort of heard about or talked about or seen some footage, but there were some, you know, it wasn't exactly new, but it was very powerful. These four police officers talking about what happened to them. You know, we saw new footage from the body cameras that they wore, and it brought it all back. And of course, you played the clip where they weren't just talking about how these sort of anonymous people were, you know, wielding bats and flagpoles and threatening them. They really talked about the former president, and they talked about members of Congress.
Jeff, what about for you?
I think what is so striking, as Anita said, it really just brought it all back to, you know, really the raw feelings of, you know, what everyone saw in the Capitol with their own eyes on January 6th, but then so much more, just the new body camera video and just hearing these searing stories from these four officers. But a couple things going forward, the politics of this, of course, have changed so dramatically. The fact that this was being held in a hearing room with the Democrats plus only two Republicans, Congresswoman Liz Cheney from Wyoming and Congressman Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, just underscored the fact that so many Republican leaders and rank and file members have simply closed their eyes to what happened that day. But so interestingly, we heard after Officer Michael Fanone of the Metropolitan Police Department, he really raised something that has been a question for many people. Where is the police union in all of this? Clearly, the police were brutalized that day. There's no doubt about it. We can see it with our own eyes. You can hear it. And the police union has been largely silent. Of course, they were large supporters of former President Donald Trump in last year's election. So just after we covered the election so much last year and seeing so many signs and yards across the country, you know, support the blue line and support law enforcement for President Trump, et cetera, they've been largely silent on this, you know, which was a police brutality at the hands of Trump supporters that day at the Capitol. But going forward, I think the most important things to watch, Chairman Benny Thompson, who is he going to subpoena? They're trying to get to the bottom of who talked to the president that day, the conversations between the Capitol and the West Wing of the White House. So look for subpoenas to start being issued, I think, pretty quickly here. And that will determine the extent and course of this committee's investigation.
Anita, what do you think about the fact that this hearing started with testimony from law enforcement officers?
Yeah, I think that was really a sign that the Democrats wanted to send. Of course, you know, Republicans largely, or many Republicans, I should say, including former President Donald Trump, talk about, you know, sort of just what Jeff talked about, that they have the support and had the support of police officers, and that they support them while Democrats are, you know, let crime go on. You know, this is a big talking point, and it probably will be for 2022 in the midterms. So I think it was really telling that they that the Democrats put these four police officers, you know, to show, look, these police officers are not only indicating what happened to them, but they're really calling out some of these Republican lawmakers and former President Donald Trump for not supporting them. For these are people that, you know, I think one of the officers, or maybe more than one, talked about how they had some of these protesters, some of these people that stormed the Capitol, had flags or signs showing that they support police, and yet at the same time were talking about killing one of these police officers. I mean, it was very striking, and it really brought a larger issue, a larger political issue, I think, to the forefront.
Well, Illinois Congressman Adam Kinzinger is one of two Republicans on the committee. Here's part of what he said.
Like most Americans, I'm frustrated that 6 months after a deadly insurrection breached the United States Capitol for several hours on live television, we still don't know exactly what happened. Why? Because many in my party have treated this as just another partisan fight. And serving on this committee, I'm here to investigate January 6th, not in spite of my membership in the Republican Party, but because of it.
That was part of Kinzinger's opening statement. Jeff, how did Republicans not on the committee respond to this hearing?
Look, they largely tried to create a series of diversions throughout the day when the hearing was unfolding. And the reality was everyone's eyes were glued to the hearing on Capitol Hill and really across Washington and likely beyond. It was broadcast on the television networks. Fox News even broadcasted the hearing.
But we should note that their audience dropped significantly when they were right. When they were airing that hearing.
Which is so interesting, right? I mean, that sort of tells you, because people have been, you know, conditioned by other Fox hosts in the primetime hour, and of course the other Newsmax and OAN, you know, that nothing happened there. So that probably tells you all you need to know. But Republican leaders, Kevin McCarthy and others, they held other press conferences. They said they weren't watching. They were too busy. Senate Republicans, who we should also point out, blocked the idea of having an independent investigation like the 9/11 Commission look into this, they also were too busy. So the reality is they tried to not focus on what was going on there, but also trying to divert the conversation to that this was a failure of Speaker Nancy Pelosi for not protecting the Capitol. The problem with that line of argument is she, of course, is the leader of the House side, but Mitch McConnell at the time was the leader on the Senate side. He holds equal responsibility and purview over the sergeant at arms and things, who both immediately were dismissed after this happened. And no one is criticizing Mitch McConnell. So they can change the conversation or try and change as much as they want. The reality here is this hearing is underway, and a good portion of the American public saw it. Will it change any minds? Perhaps not. But I think for history, the point is to get to the bottom of who knew what that day.
Anita, when can we expect to hear from the committee again?
We might even hear from them very soon. The chairman has said he wants another hearing or another meeting before the August recess, the end of the August recess. But they are supposed to be meeting now, really, to talk about what's next. And as Jeff said, we could see subpoenas coming soon. We know that they haven't ruled out calling President Donald Trump or his former officials in the White House.
That's Anita Kumar. She's a White House correspondent and associate editor with Politico, and Jeff Zeleny, chief national affairs correspondent for CNN. Thanks to you both. 1A's interim audio engineer and sound designer is Mike Kidd. He gets technical assistance from Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Chris Castano is our digital editor. You're listening to the News Roundup. We'll discuss the week's biggest headlines from around the world in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
We're rounding up the week's biggest headlines from around the globe. It's the international edition of the News Roundup. The first flight evacuating interpreters and others who worked alongside the U.S. forces in Afghanistan arrived here in Washington overnight. On board were more than 200 Afghans, including 57 children and 15 babies. We'll be watching for more arrivals. The White House has confirmed this flight was the first of many. Lots to catch up on this week in the international hour of the Roundup. My guests today are Jennifer Williams, senior foreign editor of Vox. She's also the co-host of Vox's foreign affairs podcast, Worldly. Jen, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And on the line from the Chinese capital is David Rennie, Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. Hello, David.
Hello.
So, Jen, let's start with that news about this first flight of Afghans arriving in the U.S. With the Taliban on the march, is there going to be enough time to help those we've promised to help?
It seems highly unlikely. The security situation has deteriorated just so stunningly rapidly, I think more than anyone even anticipated, specifically the Biden administration. And just to talk about the numbers that we're talking about here, this first group of 200 is just a tiny drop in the bucket of the number of people that need to be rapidly evacuated. There are some 2,500 others who are farther ahead in this kind of visa application process. It's a special visa for these interpreters. There are about 4,000 others who are not even that far along in the process. And then there are apparently, according to the White House, about 20,000 Afghans are actually in this pipeline. And that doesn't even include their families. So they're saying that the number could be as high as 100,000 people that need to be evacuated from Afghanistan and taken either to the United States directly, or the administration is working on taking them to unspecified third countries so they can kind of complete this processing. But it's just a huge number of people. We've been in this country, fighting a war for 20 years now. And so all of these people have really helped, in the U.S. war effort and have put their lives and their families' lives at risk in doing so. And now with the situation collapsing so quickly, it's just going to be a huge, huge endeavor to try to get these people out in time.
And just in very straightforward terms, what does this mean for those Afghans who provided the U.S. aid, whose escape routes are now being cut off as the Taliban advances?
It's literally life or death, Jen. It's literally life or death. I mean, these people are facing, direct threats to their lives, their families' lives, being, executed for having worked with the Americans. And so this isn't something like, oh, they might face some discrimination, or some, threats that are not really serious. We're talking about the Taliban, heavily armed, serious military power here, taking over entire swaths of the country and threatening these people's direct lives.
Well, as we're talking about drawdowns, the United States has had boots on the ground in Iraq for the better part of two decades, but U.S. forces will end their combat duties there in just a few months. President Biden made that announcement on Monday during a White House meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Khadami.
We support strengthening Iraq's democracy, and we're anxious to make sure the election goes forward in October. We're also committed to our security cooperation, our shared fight against ISIS. Is critical for the stability of the region. I think things are going well. Our role in Iraq will be as it's just to be available to continue to train, but we are not going to be by the end of the year in a combat mission.
And again, that was during a meeting with Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi. David, break down exactly how the U.S. presence in Iraq is going to change.
Well, the truth is it's not going to change quite as much as you might think from the headline. And there was a lot of kind of very careful use of language in that statement from the president in his meeting in the Oval Office. You know, he was talking about the end of a combat mission, but then you note he was very careful to make the point that American troops will be available to help fight ISIS, basically, which is still active in the region, for the stability of the region. And I think that's incredibly important because, just as we were talking about Afghanistan, where the withdrawal really is for real, there'll be very, very few American forces, a few hundred guarding the American embassy in Afghanistan. And that's because the Taliban, although unbelievably brutal, fundamentally doesn't threaten American interests outside the borders of that very unhappy country, Afghanistan. But ISIS and Iraq is different. Joe Biden was, remember, the vice president in the Obama administration when they withdrew troops the first time in 2011. And they had to rush them back in 2014 because ISIS came out of essentially nowhere, came across the border from Syria into Iraq and threatened at one point Baghdad. And that just changed everything because ISIS is not only brutal and extremely fanatical, but is also extremely effective at forming kind of franchise terrorist and radical groups around the entire region. And so America is still going to be there. It's only 2,500 troops, but it's a very careful political withdrawal about not having a combat operation, but the counterterrorism part that Joe Biden mentioned at the end could end up being tremendously important if needs be.
Jen, how do Iran and Syria play into this?
Well, hugely, specifically Iran. So a lot of this, as David said, a lot of this is very much a kind of political messaging. U.S. forces have actually been in a non-combat role in Iraq for quite a while now. A similar announcement was actually made under the Trump administration. And so this is very much trying to kind of give Khatami a boost politically because he's under a lot of pressure from specifically kind of hardline Shia politicians in his country to, you know, reduce the U.S. presence. And this is in part because of Iran. Remember, these Iranian-backed Shia militias have been attacking U.S. bases in Iraq. And Khatami is basically really worried that his country is going to further become this battlefield between the U.S. and Iran, and he doesn't want that. And so he's trying to kind of balance the U.S. interests and the Iranian interests in his country to make sure that everyone's happy enough that they're not, you know, completely turning Iraq into this proxy battle. And so he's trying to kind of play everyone off each other.
Well, Republican Senator Joni Ernst has been talking about her concerns. Here's some of what she had to say earlier this week on Fox News.
We do have a vested interest in making sure that not only Afghanistan, but Iraq remains stable. And certainly if we pull troops out of Iraq, then we know that Iran will have greater reign across Iraq. And those folks can't be trusted. I am sorry, but their will is to do away with Americans. Yeah. So we do have an interest in remaining strong in the region.
Jen, how will this news go down in Iran?
Well, you know, again, it's very much mostly a political statement. It's not going to actually change anything on the ground, particularly even the administration has been pretty clear that the numbers are probably not going to actually change that much. There are going to be maybe small withdrawals. So it's not really going to change much. It's mostly just to kind of give Khatami, you know, in Iraq, a political kind of boost and be able to say, see, I got the Americans to slow, you know, to draw down and to back off. But hasn't really. And so I don't think Iran's going to be particularly fooled by this. They're perfectly aware of that, you know, reality as well.
And we should say there are about 2,500 troops there now, correct?
Yes, yes. And that number is probably not going to be reduced by much at all.
David, how much of this is also a move by President Biden to try to move on from 9/11, which as of this September will have happened 20 years ago?
It's absolutely that. And in two important ways. Most obviously, this has been a forever war. You have people now fighting or serving in Iraq whose fathers were fighting in the same war 18 years ago. It's been going on that long. And so he's, you know, he's promising to end this. I think something else linked to that, but even larger, is going on. The Pentagon is conducting a very big review of its global posture. And fundamentally, people around Joe Biden and Joe Biden himself They think that there has been way too much blood and treasure and attention spent on the Middle East that has not ended well, and that there are bigger threats in other bits of the world. Above all, there needs to use a phrase, pivot to Asia. And I think you're going to see, in addition to these kind of technical discussions about what you call the mission in Iraq, really interesting big questions about, does the American military still want very large bases in the Middle East? Do they want to move to sort of smaller bases scattered around that try and train and advise local regional players? Even things like the US Navy has kept an aircraft carrier permanently on station in the Middle East. That's a huge drain on resources. That might be up for grabs, because maybe America is focusing on the next fights, which could be much closer to where I am here in China.
Jen, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think David's absolutely right. You know, the Biden administration, it just very much, you know, similar to the Trump administration, wanted to have this kind of changed posture of, you know, spending money here at home instead of abroad on foreign wars. And, you know, it's no coincidence that Biden is trying to sell this, you know, big infrastructure package and to really focus on rebuilding at home, in part to challenge China. Again, that kind of pivot to Asia idea that David said, you know, it's very much political, both, you know, like I said, in Iraq and in the U.S. side. But again, you know, the actual tangible change, it's much more rhetorical. And like David mentioned, you know, the Afghan withdrawal is much more significant, but troops are still going to be in other places and, you know, in parts of Africa where we have counterterrorism missions, in Syria, et cetera. So, you know, in terms of the actual reality, Afghanistan is really the big significant one. And again, we're seeing that that's not really going so well.
David, also this week, the U.S. agreed to return 17,000 archaeological treasures looted in recent years. What more do we know about that?
It's a fascinating story, and it was presented as a big win by the Iraqi entourage with their prime minister. He flew back with some of these thousands of treasures in his own plane back to Iraq. Some of these come from the horrible kind of cultural aspects of the chaos that listeners will remember at the beginning of the invasion of the Iraq War. At one point, the National Museum in Baghdad was robbed, 15,000 objects were stolen, but also sort of archaeological sites all around Iraq robbed. Some of those ended up in America, particularly in the collections. They bought them with false provenance. They didn't know they were buying stolen goods of the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. Some of those are now in a plane heading back to Iraq.
Joining us now is Emily Tamkin, U.S. editor of The New Statesman. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So we're into the second week of the Summer Games. Emily, are you along for the ride, or are you seeing this one out?
You know what? Despite myself, and I say despite myself because I think what with surging COVID cases in Japan and the fact that we're in a deadly global pandemic, this probably shouldn't be going on. But despite myself, something about the combination of countries and sports pulls me back in. And I'm caught up with the drama and the intrigue of these Summer Games.
Jen, I see you nodding along.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so hard, even though I was like, this is probably the worst idea to have these games. And I'm like, let's watch some gymnastics. I'm so excited. So you can't help it.
Well, before we get to some of the news from Tokyo, a moment to cheer from a very happy Tom Daley. He and his diving partner, Maddie Lee, fought off the Chinese to grab a gold medal for Team Great Britain this week. And Tom took to Instagram to tell his fans what he's been up to since.
The one thing that has kept me like sane throughout this whole process is my love for knitting and crochet and all things stitching. So I want to say thank you to all my followers on here for actually following along. But not only that, this morning I made a little cozy for my medal to stop it getting scratched. And then I've got Union Jack on one side and the Japanese flag on the other. And it all tucks in nicely to have a little pouch for me to carry around my medal without it getting scratched. How about that?
How about that? That's about as precious as it gets. Now, earlier this week, I talked to NPR's Tom Goldman and asked what it's been like to cover the Summer Games in Tokyo so far.
I will tell you very honestly, it's incredibly disappointing. I never knew fans were that critical to Olympic Games, but they are. And I tell you, I've been to a few venues that cost a lot to build, and who knows what their future is going to be after the Games. But having them empty really does take away from things. The excitement, these athletes are in the spotlight after toiling in obscurity for so many years, they have this one moment and people aren't here to revel in it and to cheer them on. And it really is kind of sad, and it kind of mutes the whole thing. As a journalist, it's been very challenging. There's very limited access to athletes. There's an area at each arena or event location called the mix zone, where athletes will come off the field of play right after they're finished. And they've always kind of traditionally kind of walked this gauntlet where they walk through and reporters are allowed into these areas. And this is where reporters crowd around the athletes and ask them questions. And they're always mob scenes, and they're interesting. But this year, the numbers of media allowed into the mix zone is limited. You have to kind of enter a lottery before the event. You put your name down, and then you come back about a half hour before the event, and they'll tell you if you've won the lottery or not. Mm. And if you've won the lottery, you get into the mix zone. And then when you're in this mix zone, it's no more cheek to jowl with athletes and journalists. The athletes are socially distanced, at least 6 feet away from you, and you're not shouting at them, but you know they're a good ways away from you. So these make it a very different and sometimes difficult Olympics to cover.
Are you able to get a sense of the mood of the athletes themselves?
You know, I think the athletes are locked in. And their mood, really, like any Olympics, really kind of depends on how they do. And I do think that one thing that is different is this sense of, COVID and being tested daily and trying to get through your competition without testing positive. You know, there was one prominent American athlete, Sam Kendricks, a U.S. pole vaulter, winner of the last two world championships. He tested positive, and he's been tested every day and was probably feeling, okay, I got through this day, and now he tested positive and he's out of the Olympics. That's still a very small number based on, you know, the overall numbers of athletes here, but everyone's kind of living with that dread, and I think the ones who are getting through their events are certainly they're thrilled if they do well, but I think they're happy just to get through it without being told, no, you can't compete in the Olympics.
What are some of the big moments from Tokyo so far for you?
I'll tell you, one of the more interesting events I've been to wasn't an athletic event. It was a protest on the night of the opening ceremony that I went to. And there were about 500 people there, activists and locals from Tokyo and throughout Japan, because there's just been a lot of anger among the Japanese population about these games going on in the midst of a pandemic. So it was interesting to kind of do that as a counter to the celebration, although it was a muted celebration at the opening ceremony.
What's to come in the week ahead?
Well, you know, all the news is on track and field. Track and field is traditionally the big sport in the second half of the games, the last week. So we're looking forward to that. We're also kind of noting that there are athletes who should be here who aren't. Sha'Carri Richardson comes to mind in the sprints. Another top sprinter, a male 100-meter runner, Christian Coleman of the U.S., will not be here. He's one of the best in the world. He won't be here because of doping issues. So we're kind of, this is the first Olympics in the last three that won't have Usain Bolt being a huge draw for the track and field when that starts. So, you know, we are missing a few people who could have made this a more exciting competition, but I'm sure it'll still be exciting. And as I always say with the Olympics, you know, once you think you've got it figured out, there's a drama the very next minute, the very next hour. Every day you wake up and there's drama. So I'm certainly not going to say that things will be dull next week.
That was NPR's Tom Goldman. Next to Lebanon. Its struggles are not new, but fresh reporting this week from the BBC illustrates just how deep the economic crisis has become. The Lebanese pound has lost about 90% of its value in the past 18 months. And according to the United Nations, around a third of Lebanese children go to bed hungry, with households short of food. Medical supplies are also running out, as the BBC's Jean McKenzie discovered when she visited Beirut's main hospital.
I have problems.
This is unbelievable.
Yes.
Is this the lowest you've ever had your stocks go?
Yes. And I have been working here for 16 years. Last week, a woman came. She was pregnant. She had preeclampsia. which is hypertension in pregnancy, and she lost her baby because we don't have magnesium. Had magnesium cost like 2-3 cents.
David, why have things gotten so bad?
It's just one disaster on another. So clearly, Lebanon has been wrestling with political instability for many, many years. It has this incredibly complex sectarian power-sharing government system. It also has some fairly violent groups meddling from the outside. It has reforms being blocked by the militants of Hezbollah. And as if that wasn't bad enough, they then had, listeners will remember, an enormous explosion in the port in August 2020, which killed so many people and was so devastating, not least because the chemicals that blew up had been there for a long time and just kind of left. It was an absolutely extraordinary example of the dysfunction of the Lebanese state. That made the government fall. Since then, three different people have been given the thoroughly unpromising task of trying to form a new government. And one by one, they have failed, partly because reforms are being blocked, partly because the sectarian issues are too serious. So they have now just asked someone who's been prime minister twice before, who is arguably the richest man in Lebanon. He's a telecoms and construction billionaire, Najib Mikati. He's been asked to try and form a government. And his argument is that he's a centrist. He doesn't come from one of the big political blocs or from one of the big ruling dynasties like the man who's just failed before him, Saad Hariri. But this is a country that is wrestling with COVID, with wild inflation of things like food and fuel prices. You just had that very moving report from the BBC about things like basic medicines running out. And as if Lebanese politics isn't always toxic, a really absolutely appallingly toxic situation. So he has his work cut out trying to form a new government.
Jen, in the aftermath of that explosion David talked about, there was a lot of discussion about international aid going into Lebanon to try to help the area recover. Did that actually happen?
Not really. There's supposed to be this IMF potential aid package from the International Monetary Fund. But because of all of that political dysfunction that David just laid out, those talks have been stalled and haven't really gone anywhere. There's also, you know, France, the historical colonial, you know, ruler of Lebanon, has actually laid out a pretty comprehensive framework for government reform. It's, you know, calling for a new technocratic government that'll, you know, carry out these reforms and start, hopefully, those talks back with the IMF about this potential aid package that would really help. You know, the question is whether Najib Mikati can actually get this government formed. You know, like David said, other people have tried before and have failed. And there's also the issue, you know, he has said that he will commit to doing that and is going to try to work toward that, implementing that French plan. But the problem is, you know, whether, first of all, whether he's actually committed to doing any of those reforms. He is not exactly someone who's new to the political scene in Lebanon. He himself has been the subject of several corruption allegations. Many people in Lebanon just see him as part of the longstanding problem, the political, corrupt political elite, whose job is basically to get in there and try to sidestep reforms and amass power for their own, you know, constituencies and their own side, you know, with leaving the rest of Lebanon kind of in the dust. And so, you know, the question will be whether he can actually get in there, first form a government, and second, whether that government will actually be committed to taking the very serious political and economic reforms that are necessary to get Lebanon on the right track. But it's, you know, not a lot of people are particularly hopeful that he'll be able to pull that off. And he hasn't been promising much either. He's been like, I don't have a magic wand. I'll do the best I can.
Well, clearly a story we'll be following for some time to come. Now, more often than not, the arrival of a new ambassador here in Washington is rarely noteworthy. But China's new envoy to the U.S. is the exception to the rule. Ambassador Chen Gang struck a conciliatory note upon his arrival on Wednesday. He said he was keen to repair the testy relationship between the two world powers. But he's left his mark on those who've had to do business with him in China.
He was wholly contemptuous of the press corps, and he made no bones about it. In terms that Americans might understand, he exhibited all the competence of Sean Spicer and the charm of Sarah Huckabee Sanders in the White House dealing with the press.
That's Ed Lanfranco, who reported from Beijing for the UPI News Agency for 9 years until 2009. David, I gather you've met the new ambassador. What more can you tell us about him?
So you just played a clip sort of talking about his role when he was the spokesman who spoke to the press every day. And it sounded a bit kind of dismissive. Now, it's true that he has a very abrasive side, but that's really underplaying how important his appointment is. So you have the US and China trying to work out whether they are heading into a really dangerous Cold War. This man, Chen Gang, is a big break with tradition. Traditionally, the Chinese Foreign Ministry has trained up a cadre of very super smooth America specialists who do several tours in Washington, often spend a bit of time at Harvard or Yale. They have sort of extremely sort of fine knowledge of the sort of the elite structures of America. Qin Gang speaks beautiful English, knows the world very well. He's not an America specialist. And more importantly, his rise to the top has basically been recently because he is trusted and close to the supreme leader here, Xi Jinping. And I can't talk about everything I've talked about because a lot of our conversations were off the record. But I think it is really striking that they have sent someone to the United States who does not fundamentally think that the US is in great shape. He is absolutely part of a very powerful group here at the top of the Chinese machine who think that the West is in decline. It's not coming back. That Joe Biden winning election isn't really fundamentally changing much because the country is still so racked by partisan divisions and racism and is kind of old and tired, and China is the coming power. And that fundamentally, if China relations with America are bad, it's America's fault because America is too racist and too complacent to understand that China is winning and America is losing. And that analysis, I think Qin Gang brings with him, even if in public, he's a very experienced and polished figure who may be slightly more polite, but he is extremely scornful, fundamentally, of America's chances of coming back.
Well, someone else you've met who's in the news this week is the Chinese billionaire Sun Dao. He's now in prison. Tell us why.
He's a fascinating figure. So he's actually slightly different from some of the recent kind of tycoons we've seen getting into trouble because they clashed with Chinese regulators. Sun Dao is a billionaire. He's an agricultural billionaire. He has like huge chicken farms, egg farms, pig farms. But he's also almost a dissident. So I met him a couple of years ago at this huge spa hotel next to an enormous chicken farm that he owned. And what was fascinating was he had sponsored and gathered a group of reformist economists who had been involved in the very beginnings of kind of market reforms in China, who are now very much on the outs now that Xi Jinping is pushing a much more kind of Communist Party dominated vision of the economy. And so this kind of billionaire pig farmer is actually a really political figure. And that, we suspect, is why he's just been given a very heavy sentence, 18 years, as well as 19 of his own family and employees. And that trial that's just ended with those very heavy sentences for essentially a minor property dispute with a state farm next to his one of his farms was dragged out of them after they were confessed after 5 months locked in detention with the lights on 24 hours a day, strapped to chairs for hours at a time. He talks about a sort of utter misery of his treatment, misery beyond words, he said. So this is the breaking of a billionaire who dared to criticize the Communist Party on a very political basis.
Emily, House lawmakers this week formed a bipartisan caucus to hold China accountable for human rights violations against Uyghurs. Tell us the latest on that.
Right. So, as you said, this is a bipartisan group, and their aim is to bring further attention to the truly heinous crimes and abuses that are being committed against the Uyghur population in China. To me, the more interesting part is not that they're talking about the crimes committed by the Chinese Communist Party, which, to be honest, is in vogue in both parties in Washington today. To me, the most interesting thing was that Tom Suozzi, who's from Long Island and the main Democrat announcing this initiative, spoke specifically about American businesses doing business with Xinjiang and saying, you know, you're going to say that if you don't do this business, the costs of your labor are going to go up, and that's just too bad. We should remember that earlier this year, major American companies like Nike, like Apple, lobbied to try to stop legislation from going through that would have made it more difficult to do business in this part of the world, with forced labor. And I think, I guess what I would underscore here is that realistically, these members of Congress have very limited power over the Chinese Communist Party and over what China does with the Uyghurs or doesn't do with the Uyghurs. They have far more control or have far more leverage over American businesses. And I will be interested to see whether this caucus uses it.
Now, David, this week, the first person to be tried under a new Hong Kong security law was found guilty of secessionism and terrorism. As best you know, how successful has China been in snuffing out the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong?
Astonishingly successful. I mean, if you remember those huge protests we saw in the summer of 2019, when you had millions of people defying the government over an extradition law, now you have a territory that is completely cowed. And so we had this first sentencing today of a man whose crime was he drove a motorcycle into some police officers in July last year. He had a flag on the back that said in Cantonese, "Liberate Hong Kong, revolution of our times." And his defense lawyers said, look, yes, he did drive dangerously, but he didn't try and hit some policemen. And that phrase doesn't actually necessarily mean that he thinks Hong Kong should be independent of China. He is not necessarily pleading for secession. What was really sinister was that this three-person hand-picked panel of judges, no jury in this trial. They've created this new system of law for this, this new system of courts to hear these cases. Basically said, it doesn't really matter what you say that meant. It could mean secession, and that's bad enough to stick him in jail for 9 years. And if, unless you think that that's an isolated incident, we just found out today as well that the Hong Kong police have arrested a man who was caught booing the Chinese national anthem while watching the Olympics on a Jumbotron screen in a shopping mall in Hong Kong. That can now get you arrested in today's Hong Kong.
Well, let's continue with some news from the Koreas. The leaders from North and South Korea have reopened a communication hotline that was cut off last June. The office of South Korean President Moon Jae-in said the two leaders agreed to, quote, restore mutual confidence and develop their relationships again as soon as possible. Jen, how did this agreement come about?
Well, you know, this is the product of a series of, you know, conversations that were being had over letters. They were letters that were sent back and forth between the two leaders trying to reestablish these ties. In part, you know, North Korea is, as far as we can tell, right, it's a bit of a black box right now, but it seems to be having, you know, very serious economic issues, potentially, you know, even talking about food shortages and famine. We're also not really clear on the COVID situation inside North Korea, but, you know, The Supreme Leader has come out and made these kind of very dire sounding statements. And so there's some sense that, you know, he's potentially trying to reach out, you know, to the South to kind of reestablish these ties and hopefully try to get some movement back toward the not necessarily, you know, a peace process or anything, but potentially maybe lifting some economic sanctions and just, you know, restoring some sort of process on talks with the U.S. and the South to try to ease some of that economic pressure that he's under.
And Emily, just put this into some context for us. How significant is this change for North and South Korean relations?
Well, the interesting thing is that for South Korean leader President Moon, it's actually not a significant change, right? He has long been a supporter of closer ties with North Korea. Back when he was elected in 2017, I wrote a piece with the unfortunate headline, "In South Korea, can Moon bring back sunshine?" referring to the sunshine policy, right? Closening of ties or establishing closer ties, excuse me, between North and South Korea. So he's been very clear since coming into office that he has wanted a sort of a detente between the two countries, which you know, his position is we're neighbors. We can't not live with each other if we're going to survive. So the greater change has been with Kim, right? Who there was this deepening of ties. There were many visits, and then there were the two summits with Donald Trump. The second of which obviously ended abruptly without tangible outcomes. After which Kim sort of stopped the deepening of ties with South Korea as well. So. All of this is to say that for Moon, this is not a change, right? This is what he's wanted. It's Kim coming back to what Moon has long said they should be doing.
Well, on Wednesday, President Biden met with Belarus opposition leader Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Later, the president tweeted, quote, "The United States stands with the people of Belarus in their quest for democracy and universal human rights." Now, Emily, this meeting was unannounced. What was it about?
I mean, she has been traveling the world really since last summer when, you know, Belarus had these elections. Lukashenko said, I won in a landslide. And many Belarusians took to the streets and said, no, you stole this again from us. Her husband was an opposition leader. Now, following that, she has been going to various European capitals. I mean, truly all over the world, trying to keep, I mean, even more than trying to establish the illegitimacy of Lukashenko, trying to keep the repressions that government is enacting against its people in the news. Her husband, I think it should be noted, has been in prison ever since, right? So this meeting was unannounced. It was, for us at least, outsiders, it was last minute, although there were other high-level meetings that were sort of rolled out normally. And I think what's so significant here is not that this is magically going to change things in Belarus, right? Because I think many analysts, and I tend to agree with them, would say that nothing will change in Belarus without Russia, because Russia right now, Belarus and Russia are so close, and because Putin does give Lukashenko support. What this does is say that in the highest level, literally the highest level possible in the United States, the Tikhanovskaya and Belarus have not been forgotten. And that's not everything, but it's not nothing either.
Jen, for context, where do things stand at the moment on the ground in Belarus?
You know, like Emily said, Lukashenko is not backing down. He is absolutely, you know, standing firm in his crackdown on, you know, these pro-democracy kind of protests and movements, just, you know, jailing people just kind of left and right. There is very much, you know, a sense of no room to really have that kind of pro-democracy outpouring that was there. You know, Tikhanovskaya is on this world tour in part because she can't really safely be in Belarus anymore. And so, you know, as Emily said, it doesn't seem like anything is particularly going to change, which is why, you know, among just, you know, the kind of visuals, and diplomacy of showing that Biden is meeting with Tikhanovskaya, she's also been, you know, previously calling on the administration and other countries to, you know, have stricter economic sanctions and to take more serious measures to actually try to force some sort of change on the ground. But so far, it doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Well, in May, the White House did announce sanctions on Lukashenko's government. Emily, to what extent is this an opportunity for the Biden administration to send a message to both Lukashenko and Russia's President Vladimir Putin?
I mean, I think the message sent to Belarus from the United States has been pretty clear and consistent. And while they are mulling even tougher sanctions, it would be more of the same, right? I think the Biden administration has been very clear that they are against the grievous repressions in Belarus against the Belarusian people. More significantly, when Biden and Putin met in Geneva, by all accounts, Belarus was not at the top of the agenda, right? And again, if there is to be change in Belarus, it is probably, first of all, it will have to come from within. But to the extent that it comes from without, it will not be in Washington. It will be in Moscow. So I guess this could be taken as a message to Putin that this is important to the Biden administration. But I mean, that message too is not new, right? Similarly, despite the fact that there was this meeting, it doesn't say that this is the most important thing to the Biden administration where relations with Russia are concerned.
Jen, you're nodding your head in agreement there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you just think of the massive portfolio of issues that the U.S. and Russia have to deal with, I sadly don't think Belarus ranks particularly highly when we're talking about, you know, cyber attacks, you know, these kind of ransomware attacks coming from criminals, you know, kind of close to Russia, you know, nuclear talks, right? Nuclear arms control talks, all sorts of things. Ukraine, right? Crimea, even. All of this stuff, Russian interference in, you know, which is still going on, as Biden said just this week, in terms of U.S. politics. So, again, you know, as important as, you know, to the Biden administration, standing up for democracy is in their agenda, when it comes to the bigger issues that the U.S. and Russia have to deal with, Belarus does not rank particularly highly.
Well, one other important meeting we should note, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made a trip to India this week to meet with its prime minister and senior officials. In an interview with News 18, Blinken was pushed on the U.S. drawdown from Afghanistan, and he was asked to react to a picture from this week of Chinese officials meeting with leaders of the Taliban.
No one, whether it's the United States, China, India, Pakistan, Iran, Russia, no one has an interest in a military takeover of the country by the Taliban, the restoration of an Islamic emirate. Everyone has an interest in a peaceful resolution to the conflict. And so if China is acting on those interests, if other countries are acting on those interests, that's a positive thing.
Emily, what was the aim of the secretary's visit?
I mean, I think it was a tightening of geopolitical ties, right? I think the Biden administration has been very clear that they intend to work with India in part, but not only to counter China. And by all accounts, you know, they were sort of similar minds on Afghanistan and the idea that peace in Afghanistan needs to come from the Afghan people. Secretary Jaishankar, Blinken's Indian counterpart, spoke more favorably of the Quad than I have heard before, right? And certainly more than was imaginable even a few years ago, the Quad being this sort of partnership between the US, India, Japan, and Australia. The greater challenge, I think, and I do want to flag this for listeners, is that, you know, when Biden speaks about working with our allies and partners, it's for this kind of values-based countering of China. But both the United States and India, obviously right now, have you know, there are some room for getting their own democratic houses in order. And this makes it difficult, both because when Biden goes to India, they're sort of, on the one hand, you know, civil rights groups and other American officials look to Blinken, excuse me, not Biden, to Blinken to give this message, right, that rights are important, that values are important. But on the other hand, you have India saying, well, you should concern yourself with your own polity, right? You have your own problems, we'll take care of our own our own issues here. So in some ways, shared democratic values are reason for a closer partnership. But on the other hand, they do add this extra level of burden, particularly in the U.S.-India relationship.
Finally, we should talk about Tunisia. This week, its president sacked a slew of senior government officials just days after dismissing the prime minister and freezing parliament. Jane, give us some background. What's going on there?
Sure. So the background here is there were widespread protests actually calling on the president to fire the prime minister. Tunisia has been hit extremely hard by COVID, also just have in, you know, extreme kind of economic dire straits. And, you know, the background going kind of back even further, if you remember, you know, Tunisia was always kind of framed as the bright spot, the big success story of the Arab Spring in 2011. You know, the Arab Spring actually started in Tunisia, and Tunisia was the only country of all of the Arab Spring countries that experienced, you know, protests and in some cases revolutions to actually have had their revolution produce a fledgling democracy. And that democracy has gone through some really tough challenges over the years, but it has come through each one and continued to strengthen and try to hold tight to that democratic path. The problem here is that, you know, as COVID in particular has really hit the country, and as the economic situation has not improved, a lot of people are starting to question what was the point of democracy if our government is still completely dysfunctional and if it hasn't changed anything in our lives. And so there's kind of a questioning of that and a rethinking of whether maybe we should go back to autocracy, right? At least it, maybe that way we'll get something done. And so there were these big protests. And so the president, you know, in part, framed his actions as, you know, justified because of these protests, and he's saying that he's taking over to try to get, you know, the country in better shape. The question is whether he's really doing that for the short term, and then he's going to, you know, reestablish democratic processes, or whether this is essentially a self-coup and he is returning to authoritarian rule.
Well, what are the next steps in Tunisia in that case?
Well, we don't really know. It basically all comes down to Kais Saied, the president, and what he's going to do. Everyone, including everyone in Tunisia, I think is really holding their breath to see what he does next. He just named a new security minister. So, you know, there are some kind of hopes that he will restore, you know, a cabinet and try to maybe name a new prime minister. You know, he only suspended parliament for 30 days. So maybe he'll, you know, unfreeze parliament and remove the troops that are blocking, you know, the other political groups from getting into parliament. But he could also not do that. He could also maintain this kind of emergency posture and move toward a more authoritarian rule. And so we're all just kind of holding our breath to see what happens.
Emily, are there any stories that come to mind for you from around the globe that haven't gotten enough attention this week?
Well, I have one that is based in the U.S. but will have global ramifications, which is that Biden has reportedly picked his anti-Semitism envoy. It's Deborah Lipstadt, who is a scholar, really, of anti-Semitism at Emory, and was not the progressive or the sort of the right-wing pick. Obviously, for D.C. watchers, what happens to her appointment is relevant for U.S. politics, but it's relevant for the world in that this is an ambassador position, right? So how, I think in the weeks and months ahead, if she is confirmed, I will at least be watching how she defines anti-Semitism with partners around the world.
Jen, what about for you?
For me, you know, I'm really paying attention right now to the civil war and crisis inside Ethiopia in the Tigray region. The famine situation in particular that has been caused almost entirely by this civil war is getting increasingly dire. We have, you know, aid organizations who are saying they can't get their aid trucks through. The government is blocking it. They're doing so in part to try to, you know, starve the support for the rebels in Tigray. The conflict is now spread to other regions, to other states. It is a horrific situation, and there's not a lot of attention, and we all need to pay attention to it.
David, very briefly for you.
The Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin just had a very successful trip in part with rebuilding alliances. And I just want to say, you know, it's very easy to get in despair about, you know, all the problems that Biden has to deal with. But just having a normal American president who cares about things like human rights, who isn't sucking up to strongmen, sitting here in Beijing in a much rougher neighborhood than you are in America, just having an American president who doesn't suck up to strongmen, who talks about human rights, that is a huge help to keeping the kind of world slightly on track.
That's David Rennie. He's the Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. Emily Tamkin is U.S. Editor of The New Statesman. And Jen Williams is Senior Foreign Editor of Vox. Thanks to you all. 1A Senior Producer is Jonquilin Hill. Paige Osborne is our Managing Producer. Barb Anguiano produces our podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.